Hey there, listener. Are you someone that's struggling with ADHD and anxiety? Well, I have an opportunity for you. I am so excited to let you know that I am hosting an exclusive online workshop with coach and author Sam Led to teach you how to thrive with ADHD and anxiety. This is a 90-minute virtual workshop where we will explore what is possible when we take our ADHD mind and thought patterns less seriously and discover our innate intelligence and wisdom underneath the daily dose of noise in the ADHD mind. This workshop is for you if you tend to have feelings of restlessness, are constantly on edge, have problems with concentration, irritability, and you tend to overthink and have feelings of overwhelm. This is also for the person who can't find the words to describe their anxious feelings, and sometimes they feel as though the anxiety comes out of nowhere. This is for you if you tend to feel embarrassed or ashamed because you can't focus or stay motivated at work, school, or home due to your anxiety and ADHD symptoms. Maybe you've also noticed you've become very critical of yourself and put yourself down. You guilt and shame yourself because you feel like you're being a crybaby or aren't tough enough. And this workshop's for you if you're just looking for a safe space to share the good, bad, and ugly of your ADHD journey. So please join us. We are so excited to meet you. We are only taking 20 participants, so this can be a more personal workshop that you can take so much out of. If you're interested in signing up, check out the link in my bio called Thriving with ADHD and Anxiety Workshop. I hope to see you there.
When it comes to these impossible choices, clarifying our values, what we most want to stand for in an impossible decision, that is something that we can hold on to even when we can't hold on to much else.
Welcome to the Thoughts from the Couch podcast. I'm anxiety treatment expert and licensed mental health counselor, Justine Carino. I'm here to help you understand the root of your anxiety so you can create new habits that actually stick. Toxic behavior patterns, dysfunctional relationships, and childhood family trauma are all linked to the anxiety you experience. And that's exactly what we dive into on this podcast. Join me as I guide you through flipping the script on your negative thoughts, setting healthy boundaries in your relationships, and cultivating a self-care practice that's as unique as you are. From my couch to yours, let's create your path to peace. Hello, ladies. Welcome back to the Thoughts from the Couch podcast, where we talk all things related to perfectionism, people-pleasing, anxiety management, relationships, and boundaries. I am your host, psychotherapist and mom of two, Justine Carino. I am so excited about this episode. Today, I am talking with psychologist and author, Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn, about her new book, Work, Parent, Thrive. When I came across this book, I had to read it. And while I was reading it, I knew I had to have her on as a podcast guest. I wasn't sure if she'd be able to come on. I mean, she is Yael Schoenbrunn. Who am I? But she is here, and I can't wait to share her with you and her words of wisdom. Yael is a clinical psychologist specializing in treating relationships. She is a co-host for the podcast called Psychologists Off the Clock, and she is an assistant professor at Brown University and also a parent of three children. Her writing about working parenthood has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Greater Good Sciences Center, and among others, and her new book is Work, Parent, Thrive, 12 science-backed strategies to ditch guilt, manage overwhelm, and grow connection. So in this episode, you will hear her talk about the various roles we have as working parents and how those roles can feel like they're at conflict, but conflict can actually benefit us. She also highlights the strengths of being a working parent, which includes our own happiness, but it also benefits our children, and also how to shift our mindset around mom guilt. So let's get into this episode so you can have the pleasure of meeting her. Hi, Yael. Thank you so much for speaking with me and my audience today. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself, your family, and your career?
Sure. First, thank you so much for having me on your awesome podcast. I'm really excited to chat today with you. A little bit about me. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and I also wear a number of other professional hats. So I do have a small private practice. I sit on faculty at Brown University. I co-host a podcast of my own called Psychologists Off the Clock, and I'm a writer who just came out with her first book called Work Parent Thrive that we're going to talk about today, which I'm very excited about. And then I'm also the parent of three boys between the ages of 6 and 12.
Amazing. Like you said, doing it all the things, career, family, motherhood, which is really, it's impressive. But what I really honor and resonate with is, you know, an ambitious woman who is also a mom of three, who has figured out some ways to make this juggle feel a little bit easier. And that's what we're going to talk about. So thank you. I'm so honored to have you here. You know, I was chatting with you before this episode started, and I had seen Yael's book on social media, and the title of it caught my attention. I was like, oh my goodness, I have to read this, A, for myself, because the more children I'm having, the harder it is to juggle, and B, a lot of the women that I try to serve online are working moms that have a lot of ambition for their career, too, and ambition to be present with their kids.
Yeah, and I do think that there's this common line that, you know, we say like we can't have it all, and there's some truth to it, but also I think that it lacks nuance. There is a way to have an ambitious career and be a really loving, present parent. It's not easy, but there are lots of ways that we can use what we know from clinical psychology and other branches of social science to do this whole juggling act a little bit more smoothly and to thrive and enjoy the process a bit more. And that's really where I wanted my book to sit, as like a guide that really offered a lot of social science ideas, but that was sort of the positive psychology of working parenthood in a realistic way. And what I mean by that is a lot of what's out there feels very disheartening in terms of working parent. Everything is about conflict. And unless the structures of our society change, that we can't enjoy ourselves and we can't do, it's impossible. And there is some truth to that. And at the same time, we have to figure out how to do this thing. The other piece that I think is really missing is the internal psychology piece, that some part of what is hard about working parenthood really is about what's going on outside of us. And some part of it is just something that's fundamentally human, which is we want to do all these things. If you're ambitious and you want great things for your career, you're going to be pulled to that. And if you're a parent who cares about being around your kids in a very present oriented engaged way, you're going to be pulled to that. And when we're pulled in different directions, it can be uncomfortable. That's not a bad thing, and it's actually not something we can avoid if we care very deeply about multiple roles. It's just something that's fundamentally human. And so I really wanted to write a book that talked about this kind of fundamental human reality that we are pulled towards different things, and that's not a bad thing, even if it's an uncomfortable thing.
I love that you said that, and you say this, I think, towards the beginning of the book, of like this discomfort that working parents feel, and how like the solution isn't to get rid of the discomfort, because no matter what, if we care about both things and we feel like we have to sacrifice one, we're going to feel uncomfortable. So that kind of reset an expectation for me. Like, oh wait, I'm not going to wake up one day and have this magic formula where I feel blissful and totally at ease and at peace. Like, there's always going to be some sort of discomfort juggling these roles.
Yeah, it's just fundamentally human to feel conflict. In fact, for the book, I got to interview this evolutionary psychologist. His name is Steve Stewart Williams, and he's a very funny writer and has a great Twitter feed. He's very funny. But he talks about that we are evolved to feel conflict, and it's a part of how we're wired. It's a feature, not a bug. And the reason for that is that that conflict helps us to consider what's important and what's less important, and also really defines a full, meaningful life. And in fact, research from others, not evolutionary psychologists, but people in the field of clinical psychology too, suggests that role stress is real, but also role benefits of being involved in multiple demanding roles are real too. That a full, meaningful life really means that we're going to be pulled between lots of roles. So as you're saying, we can't and shouldn't overcome it. And in fact, we're setting ourselves up for a losing battle if we try. And if we do somehow manage to reduce our roles enough so that we're not feeling conflict, we're probably going to feel like life is a bit empty. And so it's a little bit of a false bill of goods to say, you know, if we should do working parenthood better, we won't feel the conflict. But hey, what would that even mean? We wouldn't be wanted by our kids, or we wouldn't be, it wouldn't matter if we didn't show up to work. That wouldn't feel so great, because we want to feel needed. In fact, there's this great study that I talk about in my book that was conducted in the 1800s by a French sociologist, and he collected data all across Europe, and he grouped people. He was looking at what were predictors of suicide. And what he found was that the more role obligations that people had, the less the risk of suicide. And we've done tons of research since that time. And what we find is that the more role obligations that people have, the more happy they are, the better their well-being. And of course, there's, you know, at some point a diminishing returns to this end where we can feel too stressed out and maxed out. But in general, we do better when we're needed, because it gives life purpose and meaning. And that's what we as humans really need. We crave it.
Wow. So let's repeat that. Research has shown the more roles we have in our lives, the less risk of suicide. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say this to like a listener that might be like, what do you mean by roles? Let's break that down. So we have roles of mother. We have roles of partner. We have roles of employee or worker, right? We have roles of being someone's daughter. And so that's what we mean by managing these roles. And what Yael's saying is trying to be at peace that we will always have discomfort from trying to manage these roles because they're all meaningful to us.
Yeah. And I'll go a step further, because I just think this research is really interesting, that in older age homes, when nursing residents have a pet or a plant, they do better. So it's like, if you're needed by someone, even if it's a plant or a pet, we do better. So it is the case that roles help us to feel like life matters. Our life matters, our, like we're making meaningful contributions, and meaning and purpose is one way that psychologists define happiness. And yet it can feel like, oh, shoot, now I'm on the hook for this thing. But if we sort of, this is kind of what I'm always going for in these conversations, is it's a bit of a mindset shift to say it is hard, and we can have self-compassion along for the ride and be clear on where our limits are and when we need to take a break. But if we do that mindset shift to really appreciate some of the tension between roles that we experience, the experience of them really shifts. It's like shifting from a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. Most parents are familiar with this idea in academic learning. It doesn't mean that you're going to get a different score on the test in, you know, the first time that you try. But with a growth mindset, you can say, okay, I didn't do well, but that's okay. I'm okay. Like, this failure doesn't mean anything about me as a person. And in fact, it's an opportunity to learn and grow. The same thing goes for working parenthood. If we experience that tension, we can say, okay, this is really uncomfortable. What do I need here? But also, this isn't a mark against me as a failure of a working parenthood. And it's also not a mark against the world at large, even though we need to acknowledge that there are some things in the world at large that need to change. What do I need to do here to do well? And how can I take advantage of the tension or the conflict that I'm feeling internally?
There is a part in your book in the beginning also, when you're in, to highlight the struggle of the conflict of roles, you were talking about your being in California with your father who was dying, and to be there with him, to be the daughter role and be there at such a hard time, you had to leave the role of mother and you left your three kids with your husband and role of psychologist with all your patients in your practice. So here's like a big dilemma, right? And at the time, you know, first of all, I was like tearing up listening to this. I listened to it on audio and thinking of like, wow, that really is, how do you even decide where to be in that moment? What helped you decide where to shift your attention and where to put it at that time?
The book is about working parenthood. And so I am using this example of being by my father's side, because I think it resembles how we sometimes feel in working parenthood, where we're confronted with these impossible choices. Like, no matter what I choose, I'm going to fail somebody. I'm going to fail myself, because it's important to me to show up. And on a podcast of yours that I was listening to, you talked about your kindergartner who had their first field trip, and that you, in theory, you could have, right? That's part of the problem, is like, yeah, we feel like, if we can, we should. Every time we make a choice for something, we're making a choice against something else. And there's no way to do everything at the same time. So you had back-to-back patients and a podcast interview, and you didn't go on this field trip, and you felt like really bad when he told you all the other parents were there, all the other moms were there.
It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking.
I felt like I failed.
Yeah. Yes. And so I was in the chapter starts off with me in this position of going out to California. I live in Boston. I had three little kids. They were 2 through 8 at the time. And my husband, I'm also a wife, and my husband had just started a new job, and we split all the child stuff because we're both working parents. And so his mom had flown out to take care of our kids so that I could go out to visit with my father, who was dying, and my sister, who just had her first baby. And that was really hard in and of itself because my kids were really young. I felt pretty bad about my mother-in-law dropping everything to come out. And then while I was out there, my father went into hospice and had a seizure and went into a semi-coma. And when you're on hospice in a semi-coma, the deal is it's just kind of a wait until the body shuts down game. And I had planned to go back the day after he went into a coma because it was my 8-year-old was turning 9, and he had been so excited that I was coming back. It was his favorite day of the year. My mother-in-law really needed to return to her life. She had flown out from Colorado, and my husband was pretty stressed out about this new job. And I was like, I don't know what to do. There was no right answer. And amazingly, everybody was incredibly supportive. My siblings and my mom said, do what you need to do. We're going to be here by dad's side. If you need to go back, we understand. And my husband said, it's pretty stressful, but I will figure it out. You do what you need to do for your family. I'm here for you. Kids and I have it. And even my son, who's turning 9, he was going to understand. I knew everything would be fine, but I was like physically ill from the stress of making this decision and just Googling because I could justify staying a day or two longer, but I couldn't justify the month that one of the hospice nurses told me it could take until he passed away. And, you know, I was calling all my friends and what do you think? And asking my mother-in-law, what did she think? And my husband, and, you know, there just like wasn't an answer. It was impossible. And so what I did was I turned to a practice that I teach my patients that comes from a treatment called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is an evidence-based therapy. And the practice is something called values clarification. And values are defined as a quality of actions. They represent how you most want to show up in a given moment. And it depends a bit on what's going on around you, what's going on inside of you, and really is very specific to you in terms of how you want to show up, what matters most to you as an individual. And that's pretty different than a goal, right? A goal is sort of where do you want to get to and how do you want to, you know, achieve whatever the outcome is. Values are more how you take the journey. And therefore, they're a lot more in your control, right? Outcomes are really not in our control a lot of the time. Like, I did not have control over what was going on with my father. I did not have control over the situation at all. But what I could control was how I decided to show up. And the kinds of questions that I guide patients in answering in the therapy room are things like, if I could imagine myself 30 years from now, looking back on this moment, what would I be most proud of having stood for? What would make me feel like that's the person I want to be? For parents, sometimes I ask, what is it that you most want to model for your kids in this moment? What do you want them to look back and say, my parent was really showing up in this way in this tough moment? In the moment of my deciding what to do with my dad, I asked myself what I thought my dad would want me to stand for. And that provided me some clarity because he was such a committed and devoted grandfather and really so proud of my work ethic. I felt that he would have wanted me to return home and be there for, in particular, his grandson's birthday. That would have been really important to him. And so I did, I returned. And what was so heartbreaking about it is that he passed away less than 24 hours later. So in theory, I could have stayed and been with him for that final day. And there's always some regret, some question that I'll have. But the beautiful thing about values is that you can return to them and say, you know what? I stood for what my dad wanted me to stand for. I did not have control over the outcome. It did not get tied up in a neat and pretty bow where anybody felt good about anything. But I tried my best to honor my father by acting in line with what I thought he valued, what I knew he valued. And that is something that I can be proud of, even though it was extremely painful. When it comes to these impossible choices, clarifying our values, what we most want to stand for in an impossible decision, that is something that we can hold on to even when we can't hold on to much else.
Yes. And it's something that I've started to incorporate too with my clients. You know, I've never been trained in ACT, and I really want to get to a training and see what that's like.
It's an amazing treatment. It's like the, you know, I'm a therapist, but I use it for myself. It's the guidelines for how I make decisions and sort of plan my days and organize what's important to me. It's a beautiful treatment.
It makes so much sense. And I see it play out and benefit people that feel like they have, like you said, these impossible choices. Like you were dealt with, talking about discomfort, such an uncomfortable, impossible decision to try and make around all these different roles in that moment. And your values guided you to make those decisions. And I see it with many of my clients, when we tap into their values, they feel a little bit more confident in the decision. Even though the decision's still uncomfortable, they feel a little bit more at ease with going with that decision.
Okay, I yelled at my daughter because she decided to dump an entire glass of water all over the bathroom floor on purpose while just looking me dead in the eyes. And in hindsight, it really felt like a mom fail that I reacted that way. You know, her spilling the water wasn't even a big deal. It didn't matter. I was just feeling really stressed out about work, getting the kids to school on time, and it was just one more thing to clean up and deal with in the morning during chaos, and it was a little overwhelming. I'm a busy working mom, and for the longest time, this was almost a daily recurrence, yelling at my kids because I was so stressed out. And it kept happening because I didn't know how to take care of myself and get the care I needed. So instead, I became drained, overbearing, and an irritable mess in the house. So now, through intentional self-care strategies and some simple techniques for anxiety and stress management that have become non-negotiables for me, I am doing more that I enjoy and stressing less. I want you to have the same relief. I want you to have more days with less mom guilt, more moments of fun and presence with your kids, and making good memories with your family. Also, more of living your life well. Join me for the Path to Peace live group program to clarify and prioritize what you truly want for yourself and your family, and learn how to slow down and say no more often to the things that don't align with you. You can learn more about the Path to Peace by clicking the link in the show notes or heading to carinocounseling.com.
Well, and I think what values are so helpful with is that part of what is so hard about making decisions is that we as humans are wired to really dislike uncertainty. There's really interesting research that shows that we prefer certain pain to uncertain pain because at least then we feel like we can prepare for it. But unfortunately, life doesn't work that way. It's there. So there's sometimes just not certainty to be had. And so what values allow you to do is to get a lot more process oriented as opposed to outcome oriented, because you get to choose the how. So you can sort of hold on to the certainty of like, I know I'm going to show up in this way, regardless of what happens in the end, which I don't have control over. This is the part that I can manage, is how I take the steps. It's sort of like if you're climbing up a mountain, you may or may not make it to the top, but moment to moment, you can decide how you show up for your journey. You can push yourself, you can be mindful, you can pause and enjoy the flowers, or you can really rush up and get it done quickly. That is something that you can control. But, you know, if a storm comes up and you don't get to the top of the mountain, or if you twist your ankle and you can only go so far before you need to get some assistance to get down the mountain, you know, so be it. But you can hold on to step by step how you take the journey. And that's something that can be really reassuring in a life that's full of a lot of uncertainty.
I love that. You can control what you get in touch with in terms of your value. You can control the process of trying to align with a value. You can't control the outcome necessarily, but you feel the safety net of, I acted on behalf of what I'm valuing, and this is what I trust in this process.
It's sort of like you focus on the process and you hold the outcome lightly. What's amazing too is that there's this very paradoxical thing that happens sometimes, not always, but that where if you can hold the outcome a little bit more lightly and really pay attention to the process, the outcomes that you're seeking become a lot more likely. And obviously, this was not the case with my father, but for example, with ambitious pursuits like writing a book or building a podcast or an online course, that if you say to yourself, you know, I'd really like to secure this kind of a book contract or get this number of people into an online course, and you make that the focus and you sort of get so focused on that that you lose the process, that outcome becomes a lot less likely to be available to you. Whereas if you say, you know, it would be nice, but have that outcome as an end goal to kind of orient you, but you bring your attention moment to moment back to the process. How do I want to show up? What is it, this course? What is the meaning of this course? Or what do I want to express in this book? How do I want to inform people and touch their lives? And if you can keep bringing yourself back to that process, the outcome of success becomes more available than if you held too tightly to the outcome. And it's this paradoxical truth that happens in all sorts of realms in psychology. Like one common example, I hope it's okay to talk about this on the podcast, is sex. Like if you get too focused on the orgasm, it becomes a lot less available to you versus if you're able to focus more on the process and being connected to your partner.
You know, I heard of this just worded differently a few weeks ago on another podcast that was like, the ability to detach, like if you don't attach to these outcomes, like you're squeezing it in your hands and you're dying for this certain outcome, you're controlling, 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 you're focus, so attached to this outcome that exactly what you're saying, you lose sight of the process, it becomes less enjoyable. First of all, you're squeezed it so tight, it's slipping through your fingers, like happens with sand, and to really detach, and you feel differently about that outcome, and you get more in touch with the values that brought you there in the first place, which feels so comforting, feels it so much better.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this. Why do you think our generation of mothers is dealing with these conversations we're having, right? Like, I can't imagine my mom or grandmother finding a book on the shelf saying work, parent, thrive, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think it was part of their lifestyle. Why us, why our generation to have these conversations about juggling ambition with career and parenthood? And why not our mothers and grandmothers, from your opinion?
I think a couple of things. One is that we're more comfortable talking about things like this than past generations were, you know, and I think it is because we're more comfortable talking about it because it's just become much more apparent in our culture that it is okay to pursue what makes you happy and fulfilled. And that's a sign of some kind of progress in the world, that there's more opportunity. And I don't say that things are where they should be, but there is currently more opportunity for women than there were a generation ago. You know, when my mom was my age, she could have been in the workforce, but she didn't get that much schooling because that just wasn't the tradition at that time. And a generation before her was even less available. So the expectations for what was even possible were so different that who was going to talk about, you know, work, parent, thrive when you just didn't expect women to be in the workforce or to have ambition. Yeah. So they might have felt it, but it wasn't a part of the common conversation, the public conversation, because it just wasn't something that people really supported. And I do think that there's this funny, I'm going to use the word paradox again, where because we have more choice and more options, and again, there should still be yet more. And yet, there's this paradox of choice. And Barry Schwartz is one of my favorite writers on this topic. And he has a terrific book called The Paradox of Choice. But he also has a great TED talk that I recommend to a lot of my patients who struggle with choice. Because what he finds is the more choice that we have, the less satisfied we are. Because what happens is the more options that we have, the higher our expectations grow, the more likely we are to expect really maximal outcomes. And when you put that in the context of what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, where there is just this inherent fundamental truth that we get tugged between things that matter to us. And so if we have all this choice and we expect, well, we should feel good all the time, right? I shouldn't feel so unhappy. I shouldn't have to choose between one thing and another. I was told I could have it all, you know, and to be honest, I was told I could have it all as a child growing up. And, you know, my mom was like, You can have so much more than I can have. You can have an interesting, fulfilling career and a family. And my dad was similarly so supportive. You're a smart person. You love kids. Why not have both? Marry a supportive partner, get yourself a career, and do both. And then I got to that point of being a professional working parent, and it was a real surprise to me. Oh, this is really hard. Like, I knew it would be hard, but I didn't know how painfully hard. And I think this is a part of what happens when we expect things that don't kind of align with our human biology. And so having more choice, more options, and more expectations to be able to do it all is almost like a setup. And so I almost think we need to recalibrate. Like, you can have it all, but you can't be not human. You can't be not tugged between lots of different things. And we should be talking about it. And what I talk about in the book is that there's kind of the inside out, which is the psychological approach that I take, which is, you know, recognizing that the tug between roles is fundamentally human, and the outside in, that we do need to continue to make progress to support women, to reduce the maternal penalty for having children, to increase availability of family leave, whether that's for having a kid or for taking care of a sick parent. Those are changes that need to be made as well, even as we sort of recognize that more choice isn't going to undo the fact that it's hard to do lots of things that you care about. It just is.
Yes, so well said. And as you're saying this, like, I'm thinking in my head, like, yes, yes, yes. And I always joke, like, there's this part of me that, like, I would love to be with my kids all of the time at home and be there every day when they, you know, my son gets off the bus. But I would also love to see as many clients as possible and have a thriving podcast and have an online course and do all the things. And it's like, well, like, obviously I can't do both at the same time. So how do I marry that in my mind? And on a personal note, I've learned more of a balance of that, right? Like, I get to get my son off the bus 2 days a week, right? So it's not 5 days a week, but it's two. And I like that. And I'm in my office 3 days, right? And so I've learned I work for myself. So I have power of choice in this, but it is really hard for mothers that don't run their own schedule and they have to make difficult choices about, like, okay, am I working at a place where I have more flexibility to be home? Am I working at a place that has really good maternal leave time? Like, there's so many choices that parents have to make and consider when navigating this journey of motherhood and career.
I have two things to say. So one is, I do think that you have privilege that other people don't have. And at the same time, the privilege is not without a cost, because for parents who have a lot of flexibility, the decision fatigue is real. And the guilt is even bigger. I mean, again, that example of, you could have gone on that chaperoning field trip.
Yeah.
And it made you feel bad. It is different if you say to yourself, there's still some guilt, but it's a different kind of guilt if you say, you know, it's just not possible. It's not going to happen. I'm so sorry, but that's not, but you don't personalize it as much. You can sort of externalize it to, like, this is the kind of job I have. It doesn't allow it.
Yes.
And I've talked to a lot of people who work for themselves, and it can feel like constant backbending where you're trying to please everybody because you can, and that's exhausting. So it's the decision fatigue, and then it's also the role transitions end up being a lot more because you can do it, and so you do it, and every time we make a role transition, it costs us energy. So there is a cost, even though there is a privilege. And of course, there's a cost if you don't have control, because that lack of agency is really hard on the human psyche. But you don't have as much internal guilt. Doesn't mean you don't have any, and you don't have to contend with as much decision fatigue. So that's one thing that I wanted to say. The other thing I wanted to say is, what I talk a lot about in my writing and my speaking is the ways that we can take advantage of that tension. And what I think is so cool is that you are interested in all these things, but, you know, as you were saying, you know, I'd love to be with my kid all the time, 24/7. Probably, if you're like most mortal human beings, maybe I'm projecting myself, but I have that thought, wouldn't it be great if I was just with my kids all the time? But lo and behold, when I'm home with them for, you know, a long vacation or even a long weekend with no break, I start to get super grumpy.
Yes,
like
my too.
Parenting battery really gets depleted. I'm a much better parent when I have forced breaks, because otherwise I wouldn't take them, right? If I could be with my kids, I feel kind of all the time and there was nothing else calling my attention. I probably would feel like that's what I should do. And by the way, I actually really advocate for stay-at-home parents to abide by this model. Like, have some forced breaks. You will be a better parent for it. You deserve a break probably more than anybody.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the tension between roles, and this is really the meat of my book, actually offers a whole abundance of really powerful gifts that we can take advantage of if we cultivate a mindset where we approach it as an opportunity and that we use the tension to, for example, take a break from each of our demanding roles, to get a burst of creativity because we've stepped away, to force us to subtract the things that kind of gum up our system, to help us manage our stress, right? If we're stepping from a bad parenting morning into work, that's an opportunity to have a positive experience to counterbalance the rough morning. So that's an opportunity to buffer the stress. And then I have a whole section about happiness amplification, because the tension between our roles really offers us an abundance of opportunities to amplify good feelings and meaning and purpose as well.
Thank you for kind of validating me on that. You're right. And going back to like the freedom of choice, because you have control of a schedule for some people, it does get exhausting. You think you should be able to bend over backwards for everyone all the time. And when you have like a hard rule of like, no, I can't, it just won't allow it. It makes the decision for you. Yeah. But also for validating the need for the break from each role we have. Like you're right. I don't think I would be my best parenting self if I was not working and home all the time. Or vice versa, if I was always working, I would get burnt out from the amount of clients I'm seeing and what I'm doing in my job. So yeah, that is so much validation. You know, I was laughing when I was listening to your book, you had mentioned sometimes on the weekends, you'll take like a nap in the middle of the day. And I'm
every weekend, not even sometimes. I'm very dedicated about it.
I got so excited because that's what I do. I'm like, oh, there's other people doing this. So my daughter, she's 2 and she's starting to drop her nap, which is such a depressing time because we take advantage of my daughter's nap on the weekends. We're like, yes, we have an hour and a half break from a 2-year-old. My son puts on his favorite show. And me and my husband go to opposite corners and I'm usually napping. And it might be right next to my son who's watching his show and I get to kind of be there with him. But I'm a new person after that nap. And so then I'm thinking, oh, when Brielle drops this nap, how am I going to have my naps? And then when I heard you say this, she naps. I can still nap on the weekends, even if my kids aren't napping. So I thought that was so fantastic. And you also mentioned like, watching your shows at night. I'm like, that's me. Like, I need to watch my reality shows to numb out and take a break from the day from all of my roles before I go to sleep. And breaks are so necessary.
Yeah. You had on a recent guest, though, that was said that she wakes up at 4 a.m. and only sleeps 6.5 hours a night. And I was like, oh, I could get so much more done if I worked that way. But that is simply not how I work. I need a good night's sleep. I need my nap on the weekends. I need my binge shows at night. I think it is important to take a break. And just tip for, you know, parents who are parenting children who might be on the fringe of losing their nap is, you know, take advantage of rest time and make it kind of mandatory. And I will admit my kids think it's hilarious, but we still have a rest time and I have a 12, 10, and 6-year-old. But they know that their mom is going to be a happier, healthy person if they do a rest. And they don't have to sleep, and they don't obviously, but they go to their rooms and they need to be quiet. They need to not disrupt me. And it's screen-free time, but they're allowed to read or draw or chat super quietly with one another. But it's good for them. And sometimes they complain that they're bored, and that is good for them too. It is okay for our kids to be bored. In fact, boredom is the seat of creativity. And it's really good for them to learn how to be with themselves without a whole lot of entertainment stimulation that they tend to get in our modern world. So for me, it's good for me, but it's good for them too in a different way, because they're not enjoying themselves as much as I'm enjoying myself while napping. But it is on balance something that we as a family have agreed to. And I think it's really healthy and has a lot of benefit, but it's sort of like a practice. It's a habit that we have as a family, and it can be hard to start if you don't have it. But you're at a phase where you could build it in if you have sort of passed the point of no return, I think just a quiet time for your kids where they're on a screen is totally fine too, but give yourself permission. And just like you, when I started this napping routine after I read this terrific book called Rest by Alex Pong, and it just transformed how I think about resting, that rest is work's ally. If you want to be a productive worker, be a really good rester. The science on this is unequivocal. People who are really prolific over time, over the life course, know how to take breaks because otherwise we burn out. And so it's really important, especially for the busiest among us. I always think about the heart, right? The heart beats 24 hours a day because it rests between beats. We need to do that too. We can teach our kids that and be really deliberate about it. But when I first started napping, I was really embarrassed about it. And in the book, I share a story that my oldest son outed me to somebody I just met. He like told her that I was a napper, and I like blushed fiercely red. And she said, me too. And I was like, okay, like we're both a part of the resistance. There's a lot of us hidden just out of view.
I don't know many other moms that are nappers unless they have like a newborn. So when I like share that with people, like, oh, you really nap? Like I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I take advantage. I'm like, no, I'm napping. So when I heard you say that, I'm like, yes, there's another napper out there.
Well, and recently, I don't know if any of your listeners follow Emily Oster, who's huge in the parenting field and really is great about sharing parenting data, but she just recently had a newsletter about napping, and she is a napper too, and she is one of the most productive people I have ever encountered. But she does these short naps after lunch, and the science shows that 10 to 20 minute naps for adults, especially when you do it regularly, is really good for emotion regulation, for memory, for performance, for having energy at the end of the day. And, you know, it doesn't have to be like a 2 hour long thing. In fact, it shouldn't, because that can disrupt sleep at night. But if you do these short little cat naps in the middle of the day, it can be quite good for your work productivity.
Totally, totally, totally. I'm team nap with you. Do you wake up feeling like there are not enough hours in the day to get everything done? Feel a pit in your stomach when you get constructive criticism, or find yourself pressured to make everyone happy all of the time? Then you're probably struggling with anxiety due to habits of people-pleasing, perfectionism, and overachievement. You don't have to live in this state of being anymore. I have taken every ounce of my knowledge and over 10 years of experience as a licensed mental health counselor to design my first online course, The Path to Peace. The Path to Peace is a self-guided program where you'll learn my 5 core pillars to anxiety management in just 7 days. The techniques in this course are proven to help you effectively manage your worry thoughts so you can feel at ease throughout your day, understand the beliefs that drive your need to please, and so you can clarify and prioritize what you truly want, and learn how to slow down and say no more often so you have more time for yourself and what you love. You can learn more about The Path to Peace by clicking the link in the show notes or heading to carinocounseling.com. Do you have any advice for moms that are feeling guilt? This comes up so much in so many parts of my world. You know, they're like, I get it, but I just feel guilty. Like, I know that it's okay to be working and be, you know, sacrificing some time at home to make a big project happen, but there's just so much guilt around that choice. What could you say to that listener?
Well, first of all, guilt is a really normal, natural emotion, and it's wired into us. It is an inherently interpersonal emotion. So functional emotion researchers have identified that guilt has this protection of relationships function, which is that it protects our relationships, our most important relationships, from either anticipated harm or from harm that's been done. So if we're worried about doing something that would upset somebody, or we've hurt our partner's feelings, right? It sort of cues us, like, we need to own up to that and we need to do better. And that is an important emotion because we're social creatures, right? We want to belong to the group that we're in. And we also, when it comes to parenting, we want to protect our kids. So guilt, you know, in pre-modern times would prevent you from taking your eyes off your child for too long, which would have made them quite unsafe, right? Sort of vulnerable to predators or what have you. So we can't avoid it, but what we can do is be mindful of it and unhook from it. So in acceptance and commitment therapy, there's another core process that we call diffusion, which is the practice of unhooking from the thought and looking at it with just a touch of distance. And from that distance, you can ask that question of how useful is this emotion in prompting helpful action? So if guilt's function is to protect our relationships with the people we love, and in essence, to protect ourselves and the people we love, then we can ask ourselves, how well is it doing that? Now, when it comes to parenting, I'm going to go back, sorry about the broken record on this front, but I'm going to go back to the example of you not chaperoning your son's field trip, because it's a really good example of where guilt is going to come up. But here's the thing with modern parenting is that your child was not in danger at all, and your relationship was not in danger. He might have been disappointed, but actually him learning to be disappointed and come back to you and talk about it, and you guys, you know, regaining that closeness is actually a terrific opportunity for him to learn how to navigate interpersonal relationships. He also was going to miss out on time with you, but had access to all sorts of opportunities that wouldn't have been available if you were there. So for example, he might have hung with you instead of connected with friends. He might have, without you there, connected to another caregiver, which is another thing that working parenthood is actually really helpful at providing our kids with an opportunity to do. And what we know about human rearing of small children is that we're wired to do it in groups. And so that guilt can actually prevent us from engaging our group to help us rear our children. And that is not so great for them or for us. For us, we don't get as much help. We don't get as many breaks. For our kids, they don't get an opportunity to learn the kinds of lessons that we can't teach, right? Like, there's certain things I'm really good at teaching my kids, and there's certain things I am just not equipped to do. And it's really good for them to learn how to be independent, how not to have a parent swoop in and solve their problems. And so us not being there creates guilt in us. And again, that's hardwired because we're wired with these pre-modern emotions that are protective. Our culture has evolved much more quickly than our brains. And so we can't undo the fact that that guilt is going to get triggered, but we can take a step back and say, is this interfering with opportunities for my kid to engage with other people, to have independent experiences, to make mistakes without me watching, and so then to be able to pick themselves back up? Or is this a moment where, like, I really have been gone too much? I haven't put them to bed. I haven't really connected with them. Or I've been around, but I've been really distracted. And so that guilt is cueing me. Okay, it's really important for me to, like, take notice and check back in and have some quality time with my child. So again, don't worry about having the guilt. It's just going to pop up. But take it as an opportunity to ask yourself, how valuable is this? How helpful is it in pointing me to reconnect or show up in a particular way to a relationship I care about, versus how much is it just kind of a hangover and not that helpful for me?
I love that. You are so good at this. You help me take my guilt from like a 10 out of 10 to like a 2 or a 3, right? Like, the guilt's still there, but it's not the 10 that it was. It's, oh, this makes sense. You're absolutely right. He did connect with his little buddy, and the little buddy's mom did send me some photos of them playing on the field trip. And I was like, okay, he can survive very well without me in the first month of kindergarten. Like, this is okay. So you're good at this. You know exactly how to combat some of this guilt and make it so we understand it in a new way. So,
well, and it's because I've experienced it myself and I know it firsthand, but also I've read so much research on this. I just think the findings are not out there enough. There's this very cool study of kids who were sort of higher on social anxiety that were in daycare. And what they found was that that was really good for them because it allowed them an opportunity to build social skills that they otherwise wouldn't if they were home with their parent, with their primary Yes. parent, which again is not to say that it's bad to be home with a primary parent. But I think what would be helpful is that if we didn't get so fused, this is an acceptance and commitment therapy word, but so hooked on those guilt thoughts as being true and a mark of why we're bad parents if we're not around all the time, we could see that there's a cost, right? You're not available to them all the time. And that's kind of a bummer on the one hand. And there's a huge advantage because it gives them an opportunity to connect and grow in particular ways that wouldn't be available. So again, here's an opportunity that working parenthood offers that can feel uncomfortable, but actually turns out to be an enormous gift.
Amazing. And there's so much strength to it. You know, I saw an article really quickly, like, you know how Facebook feeds you things. And it was like they interviewed a mother who has
three very successful children, like all are like big names. Like this is not true, but it was like the CEO of Twitter and a brain surgeon of blah, blah, blah. And like, so like significant big time jobs and careers, and asking her like, how'd she do it? And she was saying like anything that could get them to be independent age appropriately is what I focused on. Like being able to step back and teach them to do things on their own without needing my support 24/7 is what she felt helped them get to where they are today. I'm like, that is very useful and benefits working parents. You have to teach your kids to do things independently when you're not around all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. The pressure is on for them to take on more. And that is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And I do think we're confronted with this message in our culture that good parents serve their kids, make their kids the center of their lives, and, you know, always, you know, swoop in to help them out. And if they forgot their jacket, you're right at school with that jacket or the lunch. And it really can hinder development and prevent our kids from developing self-competency to handle uncomfortable situations. It is true that we're always, this is another wiring, like we are wired to be uncomfortable if our kids are uncomfortable. It is hard to see your kid be anxious. It is hard to see your kid feel embarrassed. It is hard to see your kid fall on their face. It is uncomfortable. But it is important for us to tolerate that discomfort and give our kids a chance to push through those experiences, to have faith in them. And our faith in them can help them have faith in themselves. And that is what they need to have to be eventual self-competent adults.
Yeah, that self-efficacy. This was amazing. Thank you so much for A, writing this book, B, coming on to talk about it. How can my listeners find you, connect with you, and get their hands on your book?
Well, you can get my book wherever books are sold. It's called Work, Parent, Thrive. And you can find me at my podcast, Psychologist Off the Clock. The website is offtheclockpsych.com. And you can find me on social media by just looking for my name, Yael Schoenbrunn.
Amazing. And I will make sure I link some of those links in the show notes for listeners. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your awesome questions. And I had so much fun chatting with you. Thank you so much, Justine.
That was so validating. And the way she explains things with research behind it is just incredible. So run out, grab a copy of her book. I'm telling you, it's so useful if you are a working parent trying to manage all the emotions and all the roles you have. So thank you everyone for tuning in. Don't forget to rate or review this podcast so I can get this content out into the world and support more people on their mental health journeys. I hope you enjoyed listening to the information shared during this episode. For complimentary anxiety management tools, you can head over to my website, carinocounseling.com. Thank you so much for listening, and go enjoy all the moments your day has to offer you.